On this special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, recorded live during the California Association of Surgery Centers 2019 annual conference in Monterey, California, we interview state ASC leaders about activities of the association and issues related to California ASCs.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency, and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 66 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for September 6th, 2019. We're recording from Monterey, California, with post-production in our studios in Spencerport, New York, and Columbus, Ohio. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS. I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics.
So we're here recording from California. We're having a fun time in Monterey, which we have fallen in love with. That's the first time here.
It is beautiful. And I always like seeing the wildlife and the water. And we saw some seals. We heard quite loudly one night some sea lions barking. I don't know. I'm not sure what the noise is.
It's all night long.
Yeah.
All night long.
But they're so neat to see.
It was a lot of fun. And this is definitely an incredible place to have a conference. Mm-hmm. And thank you to the California Association of Surgery Centers and Beth LeBoyer and the board for inviting us out to do this special episode. We should note that while we're here in Monterey, we're recording actually two episodes. We're recording this special episode, which is for California centers in particular, because we're talking, you know, mainly in this special episode about what's going on in the state of California.
Yes.
And then we also recorded one of our regular episodes and had a lot of content from the speakers here, which are applicable to everybody. So
yeah, we always have a great time here. Their sessions are so informative, and there's so many people that come to talk that are really experts in the field. And they're very good about letting us talk to people and set up our podcast.
That's right. So, as a matter of fact, so much so that we actually never saw a session except one I presented. And we were recording all day on the first day of the event. So California Association meeting is one of the best state association meetings in the country. And it is certainly the largest because of obviously the number of ASCs that are in California. Mm-hmm. So we recorded a number of sessions that you'll be listening to over the next few episodes. So make sure you stay tuned for that. And as I said, make sure you listen to episode 65, where we talk about some very specific sessions that we were part of. In this special episode, we interviewed state ASC leaders about their activities here in the state. And then we're also going to finish the episode with an exclusive interview with Bill Prentice at the ASC Association regarding national issues that also impact California ASC. So let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk to the state leaders. So during the California Association conference, I had an opportunity to interview Beth LeBoyer, who is the executive director of the California Ambulatory Surgery Association. Beth talked about the activities of the organization and benefits of being a member, and she unveiled a couple of the new programs that are coming out very shortly in the California Association. I should note before you listen to it that unfortunately we could not record her in our studio, the temporary studio that we set up while we were there. I had to interview her in the hallway with a portable mic. And while the microphone performed admirably, the background noise was kind of annoying. We do the best we can to clean it up, but just be aware of that. So here's Beth LeBoyer.
So this is John Gailey. I'm here at the CASA annual conference on beautiful Monterey Bay, and I'm here with Beth to just talk a little bit about the conference and also what's going on in CASA this year. So tell us about the conference.
Oh, wow. Well, it's been a great event. This is our 32nd conference, and they just continue to get better and better every year. I'm just so excited. We had some excellent panels really addressing all the top issues that ASCs are facing, and great opportunity for the members to network. And as an association, we were just really excited to unveil some of our new programs that we are offering for our members this year.
Well, and you know, I attend a lot of state conferences, as you well know, and this is one of my favorite. I mean, really, you have the ability to attract really good speakers. You have a very active and engaged audience, trust me. And, you know, they ask a lot of questions. And even the social event, you know, was very enlightening. We got a lot of, you know, good contacts with people and conversations with people about the industry. And let's face it, sometimes that's even more important than the sessions themselves.
Right.
So
thank
you for that opportunity. I have to say, though, the sea lions, we're making an awful lot of noise here. You can hear them pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, it makes sleep a little difficult sometimes.
So what's going on with CASA? Why don't we just start with the legislative agenda of CASA over this year?
Yeah, so from a California legislative perspective, in 2019 is pretty quiet for surgery centers. But let's be clear, the governor and the elected officials, healthcare is a real priority for them. So we expect to be very active in those discussions. ASCs are kind of in a perfect niche as they look to driving down healthcare costs. That's what a surgery center's, you know, that's our message, providing great care at a lower rate. So that's what we'll be active in those discussions as they move forward, looking to make sure that the state is allowing to, you know, do procedures as Medicare further expands their list as well.
Making sure that the same things that you can do at the federal level through CMS, you can actually do in this state, which is a challenge sometimes in California.
Yeah. But I would say it's exciting times for surgery centers as this healthcare discussion continues, not only in California, but across the country. This is what we've been talking about for years, and I think folks are starting to realize how we can be part of that solution.
It's an exciting time, definitely, to be in the industry. Tell us about some of the newest initiatives you're rolling out. You're very proud about some of these initiatives. Just tell us a little bit about
So at last year's conference, we surveyed our members just to kind of see what they were looking for. And they kind of highlighted their three biggest concerns is one of the questions we asked them. First one, obviously, you know, and it probably goes across the whole industry, is reimbursement. Mm-hmm. And but I was kind of surprised. The second one was staffing and the ability to retain staff and have qualified staff in their surgery centers. And then the third one was, you know, regulatory help. So we took that staffing discussion really seriously. What could we do to help our surgery centers? And we reached out to AORN, who has the perioperative 101 training, kind of the pillar standard in the industry for training OR nurses. So we reached out to them, you know, what could we do? And the CASA board made a conscious decision effort to put some funds in there to help our members be able to access this training at a significantly reduced rate. So we're very excited to provide that to our members, and hopefully that will be a great resource for them to help with those staffing needs. Other things under the regulatory environment was just trying to help with the whole emergency preparedness initiatives. I mean, it could be really confusing. So we put a lot of resources together to assist with that. And, you know, putting the connections for the counties and, you know, providing that dialogue. We were able to create a pretty in-depth emergency operations plan. So they can download that template, and really it should meet all of their needs. Mm-hmm. So excited about that. That was a big endeavor. And then probably the biggest thing that we're rolling out is our opioid sparing initiative. And that was something we just realized, the opioid crisis is so huge in across the country. And what could we as an industry do to, you know, kind of address that? And in those discussions, we reached out to the California Society of Anesthesiologists. Mm-hmm. So we were able to work together on that and kind of come up with, you know, a collaborative discussion on an approach. And so We basically have this toolkit for our members to put some programs in place at the surgery center level to reduce the amount of opioid usage and educate patients and provide that additional discussion with their surgeons so they can be kind of leading the community with the opioid sparing. And then these are things that they can market with their health plans and in the community that they are being proactive in providing a solution there. We've got a pledge that they can sign, and then they'll receive a certificate that they're part of this program. So we're very excited for that.
What's coming up in your educational program over the next 12 months? And where's your next conference for those who are unfortunate enough to miss the conference?
Yeah. So actually, our next biggest one is in November, and that will be our infection prevention seminar, where we go through all the things a center would need to train an infection preventionist to meet those CMS requirements.
So they can actually use this course and the certificate that comes from it to prove to a surveyor that you're qualified to be an infection control coordinator.
Correct. And actually, since the new CAPE came out, we've taken the program, so we meet all of those modules too. So that would help any, not only meet the CMS requirements, but also help the person if they want to take the CAPE exam or also keep their CAPE certification. And we also have some of the California Department of Public Health as part of the faculty. So it's good. It's a good collaborative relationship there. And we talk about the biggest areas of concerns they're seeing. And then so surgery centers can be making sure their infection prevention program is top-notch.
And thank you. On behalf of, I, of course, I'm on the board of Ambulatory Surgery Center Accreditation that oversees the CAPE and the CASC program. So thank you so much for being very supportive of it and developing programs to help keep our newest CAPE members certified there.
Absolutely. So. I think that's a real win for the industry. So I think, you know, if centers should look to try to have a staff member who receives that certification.
Before the government tells us that we have to.
Right, exactly.
Lastly, tell us about the benefits of membership.
So, you know, as a member of CASA, we kind of look at it as a three-legged stool, perhaps, you know, legislative advocacy. That's a harder one to get your, you know, arms around, but so important. And so we are the only ones really advocating on behalf of surgery centers in California. So that's one important pillar. The other is all the benefits that we provide with education, some of the tools that we just talked about for the perioperative training, the free benchmarking, work comp calculator. We did an ROI tool, and it's amazing. You more than get your membership dues back with all of the programs that we offer. And that's what we're all about. You know, our goal is that you just have to be a part of CASA because it makes everything run so much smoother. And I think the third leg of that stool would be the networking in the community, because I think that's what the ASC industry is all about, is that niche and getting to know others that are practicing. It's a different industry where it's competitive, but it's also very collaborative. And that's really important component that we want to keep strong in CASA.
Well, and I want to thank you, too, because one of the things that I find as a member myself to CASA is that whenever we have a question, we can come to you. And you might not know the answer right away, but you certainly know where we need to go and can get the answer if you don't have it right away. And that's been an incredible benefit to us as we try to understand what's going on in a state that we don't spend as much time in as we do in other areas. So thank you so much for that.
Of course, that's really important to us. That our members know that that's what we're here for them.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for your time, Beth.
Appreciate it.
We just want to thank Beth. I know it was a very busy time for her, which is why we interviewed her where we did, because she had quite a lot to do, as you can imagine.
Literally catching her in the hallway, in a stairway, as I remember right, standing up doing it. So she was very gracious. And again, thank you, Beth, for inviting us out to California. We love being out there and love that opportunity. Next, we interviewed Tara Vale, who is a board member for CASA. We had some challenges trying to interview people because they were so busy during the meeting. And we were able to get Tara, and she was interviewed, at least in the
in our podcast room. They gave us a wonderful place to sit, so it was
nice.
And
it was
the quality should be much better.
That's right. It was actually a boardroom they gave us, so it was very quiet. So Tara talked, she kind of elaborated on some of the issues of California ASCs and what they've been dealing with in the last year. She's also a relatively new board member, so she talked a little bit about you know, how she came to that. So here's Tara Vale, a board member for CASA.
John and I are here talking with Tara Vale, the Chief Operating Officer of HST Pathways ASC Software and a board member for CASA.
So thanks, Tara, for joining us here. We're doing a special episode, of course, about the California Association, and you're the designated representative of the board here. So, yep. And I understand you're a new board member. How did that happen?
I am a new board member. This is my first year. I started officially in January, and coming to the meetings and participating in them over the last number of years, having the opportunity to do more. I had already started to volunteer on a lot of the committees, a lot of the planning committees for the meeting, and just getting involved. I do a lot of the ask of fly-ins and the lobbying events that the California Association puts together. And as you get to meet more and more of the members and you see what they're doing, I really wanted to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And from looking at the makeup of the board, having somebody represent the technology component was new. It had never been done for the CASA board before. But yet technology is critical to all of the surgery centers. So when you look at 750 plus surgery centers in the state of California, and you have all the management companies represented and a lot of their quality reporting and all of those types of things represented, but not the technology component, where in order to make a lot of those things happen, you need that voice.
Right.
Uh-huh. So I was really excited to be a part and play that role for the board.
Plus giving a voice to the vendors too, within the board, the vendors in general, not just technology vendors, but everybody else there. I'm sure that's an important part of
what challenges.
You do.
I mean, when you're trying to get new measures pushed out, you need to be able to get that data out of the system. Yeah. If you are trying to change the way certain things are being done, the vendors need to be aware of it. And roadmaps need to be done. And there's a timeline. So it's making sure that lawmakers understand that all things are possible, but things don't turn on a dime. We also have compliance that needs to be done to make sure that our software is quality tested and secure and all of those things, but it takes time. So even a minor change that makes life a lot easier for our centers, but also gives the data required for regulatory reporting, which tends to be like the normothermia type of thing. Mm-hmm. It just takes time. And being that representative voice for vendors, as you say, additionally, things like interoperability. Well, we all want interoperability, but yet if there's no standards and all vendors are left up to it, you're somewhat at the mercy of what another vendor can do. So even then, not all things are possible until standards are created and you've got somebody to help participate in those discussions to help make that happen.
Now, you live in California.
I do.
So getting involved at this level now on the board, what's been one of your biggest surprises?
I think really getting to understand the macro challenges of the surgery centers as a whole. I see it from one side of things as a vendor. But one of the largest challenges our centers face today is staffing. I see that on the vendor side because it's one of our challenges, make sure that, you know, users are trained. But really, when you're looking at the staff shortages and trying to provide that quality care and to really see that at a macro level, I think the other thing that I am now much more acutely aware of is how much the CASA board does as far as lobbying and how the stroke of a pen can really impact the surgery centers for the whole state. Right. So having that proactive approach all the time in Sacramento is really invaluable for these centers to represent their needs. Today, we were talking about cardiac procedures and how the Medicare as a whole allows it, but the state of California doesn't. Well, somebody made the stroke of a pen and made those decisions years ago that needs to be reevaluated, but they don't necessarily see how much of an impact to the patients because they're not in it every day, whereas our centers are. So to have CASA representing them in Sacramento to remind them, if Medicare as a whole, who's extremely conservative, is allowing this, and the state of California is not, and California touts being incredibly progressive in a lot of ways with healthcare, it's time to reverse a decision that might have been made with different information years ago, or even different technology years ago, and no longer applies. So the CASA board invests quite a bit of time and resources in making that type of information at the forefront of legislators. And to me, I you know that they're doing it, but to the extent, it's really impressive.
So that's one of the great benefits of being a member of CASA and supporting it. What other benefits are there for members?
CASA provides a lot of benefits for members at such an affordable price. And for centers that aren't yet a member, and you look at the education, just the CEU credits that go into it, all of their clinical staff needs to maintain their education credits. The benchmarking, as we've talked about, as far as the salary benchmarking and how do you maintain the staff?
Yeah, that's, I think, invaluable. Hearing what other centers are doing and even just networking with people.
Well, so we've, you know, we're very familiar with the various benchmarking products, and we'll talk a little bit about this with Beth, but we're familiar with the benchmarking products, and really the two states in the country that have the best benchmarking programs at this point are Ohio and California. And I believe they actually use the same base, if I remember right. And that's a huge benefit to centers, not just because it's required for accreditation purposes. Let's face it, you know, you can get benchmarking products a lot of different ways. That's not the only reason you should go into benchmarking. You should be going into it because it's going to give you a very valuable service. And of course, you work with HST software, which generates a lot of the statistics that have to be used or given to the users there. So I imagine that's a big benefit to the members of the association, but that's a huge benefit. What other things do you
think? Some of the other ones. So, I mean, we talk about the grassroots campaigns. I talked about lobbying and what they do on behalf of that. Those are all things that CASA does on behalf of its members. If they need any help with some of the media challenges that have come up over the last year, CASA is a resource for them to be able to say, how do I combat that? This might be a local media story, but it's negatively impacting my center, even if it's not related to their center, and being able to provide them the resources to do that. When we talk about education, some of the things that they're doing with the perioperative education for nurses. We have looked at things for safety. We put on quarterly seminars for the members to be able to participate and get educated in specific areas, whether it's legal or surgical site infection or whatever it may be.
As you were talking about staffing earlier, that's just so important to be able to train people to work at a surgery center to do some of that type of thing, because it's just always so challenging to fill those spots when you...
My daughter, Jenna, who periodically comes on our podcast and is a former co-host of the podcast, she spent 5 years out in Reno, Nevada. And one of the things that she had to deal with is all of the nurses would go to Reno, get their experience, and then go over the border into California where they would be paid more. Which I'm sure is no easy task for everybody over there. And because your shortage there was so dramatic, it's just that it really has impacted the whole coast there. So education, getting people, fortunately, right out of school now, you know, into the industry, at least knowledgeable about the industry or knowledgeable that this is a good pathway for them in the future, has got to be an important thing.
And our centers are losing them to the hospitals and the health systems that are paying big bonuses and things like that. I think one of the most, kind of going back to some of the benefits that CASA offers to its members, and most recently, and it was rolled out at this meeting, is the opioid toolkit. And to talk a little bit about that, really excited, have worked with the team to get that rolled out. And the opioid crisis is everywhere today. It's all over the news. And say, you know, how can surgery centers participate in it when it's the doctors who's writing the prescriptions, and can you put a quality measure around it? But it's really the doctor, you know, this back and forth. And ultimately, the CASA board came together and said, you know, what can we do to work with our centers? Because when a bad media event happens, it's a surgery center that's impacted. And if somebody comes out and says, such and such person died of an overdose because they had a surgery down the street, it's a surgery center that's impacted. So what this opioid toolkit does is really create a framework for a conversation both with the staff, the physicians, as well as the patients. So this toolkit is, it's a poster inside of the surgery center that gives kind of best practices. It's not to say opioids. Opioids are important to help control pain, but it's setting the expectations and creating the framework for the conversation with patients of what is your pain plan? What is that plan of action of starting with ibuprofen? This is what you should expect. This is when the block is going to start to wear off, and all the other things that go into it. And we've partnered with the California Anesthesia Association as well, because they're part of that plan as well. Coming out of all of these tool things and pamphlets for patients is a pledge, and it allows the entire staff to come together and say, we're going to adhere to best practices, and we're going to agree, whatever that agreement may be. For your center, it may be we're only going to give opioid prescriptions that are 5 days or less, because beyond that, the rate of new patients who've never had opioids getting addicted, it goes up tremendously. Yeah. And when you're at greater than 11% of surgical cases and patients getting addicted, that's a really terrible reputation and undermines all the value that we're pushing and all of the things that we do for promoting lower cost, safer place, lower infections, all those things. It undermines the message if surgical cases as a whole, patients are coming out and they're addicted to opioids. So for us as an industry, particularly for California, to get ahead of that and say, we're going to work with our surgery centers to come up with a pledge that engages the physicians and the nurses and the entire surgical team to say, we're going to adhere to best practices. If they get that pledge and provide it back to us, we will provide them a certificate that they can put into their website. They'll get a badge on for marketing and be able to put on their website or any other material that says, we adhere to best practices. Patients are coming in terrified too. They don't want to come out and they don't want to be addicted to drugs because they followed the physician's prescription, or just there's so much misinformation that's out there.
Yeah, it's so scary. So, that's such an exciting thing. We're so passionate about that because you can't undo the damage once it's done. I mean, you can't fight it from that end. So this is great. And what you said about expectations, that's such a huge part of it, is if patients can understand, you know, they're probably going to have some pain and not writing those prescriptions for so long, because they'll probably be okay after a couple of days and move on to something else. Just having that conversation, that's great.
And if you're really not, then you can just make a phone call and add it. That's
setting
better
expectations.
To do that.
But it's also, there's a shift with the physician, because you have just habitual practices that say, I'm just going to write a script for 30 days. And that script for 30 days, as a patient, you might take 3 days and then it sits in your medicine cabinet and then you have who else might be have access to that.
It could be diverted, or you could be a patient that's just like, I don't know, I have this medicine, I guess I'm supposed to take it. Just doesn't know, and then they take it, and at that point, they've passed that point of addiction.
So it's having those conversations with physicians to change prescribing practices, having the conversations with patients that's reset some of the expectations, and then really making that visible and aware for all of the clinicians in the center, and that visible pledge for patients to see.
Yeah. Patients are becoming so aware of that, you know, seeing that on their website or whatever, it's going to make a big difference. They're going to be happy to see that.
And they're going to ask a question when they come.
Yeah,
they will. And that is the best outcome. If you have patients coming in and asking informed questions because they read something that says, you know, is this right? Yeah. Then they're going to question their doctors too. And they should. They really should. Yeah. I think the added benefit of this entire pledge and the toolkit and centers that really jump in and say, yes, we're going to do this, is providing that information to lawmakers. One more toolkit, one more nugget for lawmakers to say, this is why you should be sending patients to outpatient surgery, to the outpatient setting, because look how proactive we are in trying to get ahead of these things that impact all patients.
Well, and to that end, one of the things that's been interesting on this podcast is the number of times that we've talked about it in the last year. We attend a lot of the state conferences, and almost every single state conference, they have a session about drug diversion, about the opioid crisis, and how to find solutions that are non-opioid. So that's great. I'm glad to see the association getting really on top of that and being one of the first in the nation, definitely, to develop some type of a program.
I'm excited. Yeah. I think it's a starting point. I'm a kind of a gung-ho, would love to see it go, you know, hey, let's get reporting. Let's make sure that we aren't prescribing these huge amounts. But you have to start somewhere, and you have to create a groundswell of change behavior, and awareness is the first step of that change behavior. If you don't know how to start that conversation with your physicians, and you don't know how to change that shift with getting patients engaged in that, this is the framework, and really awareness is that is probably the most impactful thing we can do to change that behavior.
Yeah.
And this has been a great conference, by the way. You know, unfortunately, Sue and I actually haven't attended any of the sessions because we've been interviewing people the whole time. But luckily, we've been interviewing people that have actually been putting on the sessions. And we can see it's been a great agenda, great job putting it together, the team that puts the program together for the organization. And I love your enthusiasm. You know, that's, I don't know, I've been on the board for my state association for so long. I don't know that I, well, first of all, I'm a lot older, but I don't have that enthusiasm anymore. I love
love doing it. It's just after a while, you know, you've done it for so long, but, you know, we got to get new blood on, and this is a great thing for the association. Plus, as we said, bringing on somebody with a vendor perspective too, which is definitely mm-hmm. important. So thank you so much for your time, Tara.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. And again, we would like to thank Tara for taking the time to speak with us. It was a great interview. I really enjoyed it.
So let's take a short break, and then we're going to come back with a special interview with Bill Prentice, who is the Chief Executive Officer for the ASC Association.
John, ambulatory healthcare strategies is really growing fast. We've been adding employees steadily over the past 12 months. Can you tell the listeners what's been happening?
So clearly this podcast has been very popular, mm-hmm. thanks, of course, to you and me, because mm-hmm. of our wonderful
of
work here and our infectious, I don't know if I should be using infectious personalities yes, in a podcast here about infection control and various items, but definitely we're enjoying doing this, and certainly the word is getting out about the great things that we're doing at AHS. So recently we added infection prevention consulting to our services and mentoring of infection control preventionists in your organizations. And that's being headed up by Lori Rodericks, who is our newly certified CAIP individual. So she has mm-hmm. the Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist certification now. And she's always been doing infection control for us, but now she's got this new title. So she can do ongoing infection control consulting, particularly if you don't have a qualified IC person on staff. She can help you in following up on infection control issues. She can do mentoring of infection control staff. And she can do infection control and sterile processing competencies. And we've also enhanced our life safety services by adding Jim Masters to our staff. He is a life safety surveyor, and so he joins Alex Borneman, who is our director of operations, to be able to do various life safety surveys and consulting on life safety issues, as well as probably the most important thing is follow up on life safety citations. That's mm-hmm. a very difficult area for many organizations to be able to deal with. You know, what happens when you get a life safety citation? How do you deal with that? So we now have that ability. And of course, our unique retainer-based regulatory services, where we help keep you on top of all the ASC regulatory requirements and always make sure that you are survey ready.
So during the California Association meeting, I had a great opportunity to interview Bill Prentice, who is the Chief Executive Officer for the ASC Association. We've been trying to get him on the podcast for quite a while now, and he graciously gave us quite a bit of time to interview him. And we're going to do an episode with him uh-huh. for everybody, but we thought we'd include this interview in the California Association meeting because a lot of the topics that he talks about have both state and federal implications. So here's Bill Prentice.
John and I are now here with Bill Prentice, the Chief Executive Officer for the ASC Association.
How you doing, Bill? It's great to have you finally on the podcast.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here with you both. I'm sorry it's taken this long for us to get together in this setting, but I'm hoping it's worth the wait.
Absolutely. You know, I was talking to Beth LaBoyer earlier today, and I said, it took us to go to California to talk to Bill. You've been at almost every single conference that we've been recording mm-hmm. from. So, well, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, I'm hoping I don't disappoint.
So, we've done a couple episodes about the 2020 payment rule that came out in, it was almost August, I think, by the time it came out. So I thought we'd just follow up a little bit with you as to what the ASC Association's take on the rule was, what some of the big highlights were, what you would like to have seen in there, and how you've responded.
Sure. We were really pleasantly surprised with this rule, and I recognized there weren't a lot of moving pieces to it compared to some of the rules we've had in the past. But we were particularly happy to see that CMS continued the policy it instituted last year in terms of updating ASCs for inflation using the same inflation factor as the hospital outpatient departments. That change from the consumer price index for urban consumers, the inflation factor that they formerly used, to the hospital market basket has been very positive for ASCs. In fact, we've received the two highest inflationary increases over the one last year and two, and the proposed rate of 2.7% for 2020 of my entire tenure at ASCA. So it's really positive.
And as we've pointed out to our listeners before, just because we got a
The 2.2% increase doesn't mean that everybody is going to get a 2.2% because of the
no. There's obviously a lot of different issues. There's a lot of, you know, regional variations in payments that take place, and that is particularly apparent when you look at another provision that was in the proposed rule that we were very pleased to see, which was moving the total knee arthroplasty procedure off of the HOPD list and now allowing it to be performed on the ASC list as proposed. Mm-hmm. And if the one concern we have that has probably been noted by others is when you look at the national average of what they're proposing as a payment for that in the ASC space, it's around $8,600, which again varies widely based on the wage indexes and other reasons that you've probably informed your listeners about before.
Especially since we got people in New York City at the very high end and people out in the rural.
So that variation can range from $12,000, which is approximately what the national average for the HOPD price is, down to around $6,000 in some rural areas. So one of the things that we're really hoping is a lot of the ASC members out there that are doing total knee procedures will submit comments to CMS by the September 27th deadline and recommend what they think an appropriate price would be. Now, I have to be honest, the likelihood of CMS changing that price this year is very slim because they've really baked in those numbers already into the budget. However, they could use that data and hopefully increase it next year for the 2021 payment year. So it's really critical that as many ASCs as possible submit data to CMS about what they think a fair price would be.
And the ASC associations provided some tools for them to be able to do that.
Absolutely. We provide some template letters that members can use to add in their own personal information to and submit that to CMS. It takes only a few minutes to do that. It's something that we're really encouraging ASCs to do.
Especially those centers that are doing these procedures or considering doing them.
Particularly those. Because it's critically important. This is one of those situations where the more feedback CMS receives matters as much as what feedback they receive. So we'll obviously be providing substantial feedback and comments on everything in the rule. But on things like this, where we really need to move the needle with CMS, it's important to get a lot of feedback.
Yeah, and you've seen results from people giving feedback and from things you've said to them. So it is going to matter.
Well, and last year, the whole impact of the vascular access surgery, too.
That and that's the thing. Like, one of the things that we have been doing more and more over the years is trying to bring clinicians to CMS, to Baltimore, to talk about what they're doing safely on commercial patients in an effort to get those procedures put on our allowable list for Medicare beneficiaries. And so it's something we're going to continue to do. So if there's anyone out there that is doing something commercially that currently isn't on the Medicare list and would like to help us to educate the medical directors there at CMS about it, we would love to hear from you.
Any other surprises in the in this year's rule?
No surprises. I think we were still pleasantly surprised to see the addition of additional cardiac procedures. That's obviously a growing area in the surgery center space. And it requires pretty substantial investment in a surgery center to be able to have the correct facility for those. But it's the type of work that ASCs were born to do. And things that we can very safely perform and have been doing it on the non-Medicare population. And that's the type of thing that we need to see more of. But, you know, as interesting as it is and as excited as, you know, the ASC community gets about getting these new procedures added to our list, I think we can't lose sight of the fact that it's critical that we do more of the very common procedures on Medicare beneficiaries for which too many are still being performed in the hospital outpatient space.
It's shocking that we still see a lot of those common procedures there.
Well, using colonoscopy, screening colonoscopy, one of the most common procedures performed in ASCs, the fact that we are not doing even 50% of the Medicare beneficiary procedures. Is appalling.
That's a bit of a shocking statistic. I didn't know that.
It's when you think of the the millions of dollars that is being wasted by paying a hospital outpatient department roughly twice the amount of the ASC to perform that very common procedure, when we know that there's only a very small patient base that is really at risk, where it needs to be performed in the hospital. We really need CMS and, you know, our lawmakers in Washington to really get a handle on that and try and find a way to migrate that care from the more expensive setting to the surgery center. And if we do that, we can save the Medicare program hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. We can save the Medicare beneficiaries a ton of money on copays. And that really needs to be a priority for us. So as fun as it is to get new procedures like total knee added to our list, we really have a lot of work to do to try and get these more common procedures, more of them migrated to the surgery center.
So Medicare quality reporting, you and I have actually talked about this a number of times over the last year, especially after the 2019 payment rule came out and, let's be honest, kind of gutted many of the Medicare quality reporting items. So this year they did not add back in 1 through 4. They've proposed to make it not through the billing system, which actually I think is a good idea. What are your thoughts on what happened with the Medicare quality reporting this year?
Yeah, I would say that the actions that CMS took last year to suspend those first four measures, which were wrong site, patient fall, patient burn, and hospital transfer, was a combination of two factors. One, the great results that ASCs were providing in terms of their data submissions, showing how rarely any one of those four potentially adverse events occurred. So that the fact that so many ASCs were reporting so few bad outcomes led CMS to, you know,
and we don't need to report them.
Recognize that they don't need to do that. Then on top of that, there was also the fact that the Trump administration, as they've shown in so many other areas of government, are trying to reduce regulatory burden.
Right.
And I think they viewed that desire of trying to, you know, CMS trying to show that they were reducing regulatory burden with the great results that we've been showing led to where we were with those four measures. Now, that said, as you're probably aware, last year in our comment letter, and I think this year in our new comment, we're still going to tell CMS that we would prefer to continue to report on those four measures and actually not just report on Medicare outcomes, but to report on all patient outcomes. That we think that those four measures, regardless of how good we've been doing on them, are so elemental.
Right.
In terms of their patient safety value, that we should continue to report on them. So we'll be doing that.
And that's what's good about the proposed change here, where they would be reporting it through ASCQuality.org.
Well, exactly. And then, as you may know, also from this proposed rule, they've actually recommended that HOPDs actually report on those four measures. Right. So again, that would allow for an apples-to-apples comparison across the ASC setting with the HOPD setting on those four very, I think, important measures. So it's something we still advocating in support of.
So moving on, one of the issues that we come from New York, and one of the issues that came up a number of years ago is a surprise billing act that you know, changed some of the ways that we do business in New York. And now suddenly we hear about surprise billing at the national level. So the Trump administration has proposed some changes. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Again, this is another place where I think the President Trump himself, through some actions he's taken in terms of inviting in some patient groups over the past 6 months, has highlighted, you know, the importance of this issue, that there are too many patients out there that are being subjected to a surprise medical bill that they were not aware of and quite frankly, probably can't afford to pay because of the way our system operates. Now, this obviously most often occurs in the emergency setting where a patient presents himself or herself or a family member in an emergency room thinking that that hospital from prior knowledge is in network with their insurance provider and that they will only be subject to whatever copays or deductibles they usually pay, but then finds out that there was a provider in that emergency room or somewhere ancillary to that that was not in network. And as a result is, you know, sending a bill to that patient that far exceeds what they expected. And I, you know, Congress has really spent a lot of time fighting over ways to try and address this issue. It's relatively bipartisan, which is a, you know, a unique thing for what's happening in Washington, D.C. today, where you have Republicans and Democrats both acknowledging the same problem and acknowledging that there's a couple of different potential solutions to it. And that's, of course, where the battle is the solution. And that's where I think you're seeing the provider community, the insurance community, at odds with each other and amongst themselves about the right solution. And essentially it comes down to two approaches to deal with the surprise bill. In both of them, the end result is to leave the patient out of the middle.
Yeah.
So the patient's not going to have to pay that surprise bill in either instance. But the two approaches are vastly different, one of which is more in favor of what the insurance companies want, which is to rely on some median contracted rate in that market that the out-of-network provider would be, you know, forced to accept as full payment for his or her services. Versus what I think is the provider solution, which is to go to a baseball-style arbitration. For those of you who don't follow baseball closely, the idea behind there is the provider would present to an arbitrator her suggested reimbursement for that procedure, and the insurance company would present theirs.
Yeah.
And the arbitrator would be required to choose one of those two numbers. So they wouldn't be able to split the baby. They'd either have to accept one or the other. The idea behind that and how it's apparently worked in baseball to most people's satisfaction is it results in both sides presenting a reasonable number. Because they want to be the one the arbitrator picks. So the problem is that I think most of the legislation that has received bipartisan support right now is defaulting to the negotiated rate rather than arbitration. So there's a lot of money being spent now to try and convince Congress to go the other way. You create that kind of choice for Congress, and unfortunately, the most common result is they kick the can down the road and nothing gets done.
So that brings up the next question is, what chance do we have of that happening during this?
I think we'll know soon. I think that if this doesn't get to the president's desk by mid-late fall, I would say the likelihood of something happening in this Congress is pretty slim. We're obviously going into a presidential election year, and we'll have the entire House of Representatives, one-third of the Senate up. That is an extraordinarily large, distracting event for policymakers.
Especially right now with the environment in Washington.
So
why don't you tell me a little bit about your legislative agenda for this year?
Sure. Well, we're obviously being supportive of our physicians on the surprise medical billing issue. Interesting thing is that because ASC procedures are scheduled procedures, we are not sending surprise bills to anyone, which is a good thing. However, we are aware of the fact that, we have contracted anesthesia services, we have, pathology services that are frequently used in the surgery center, and those providers may or may not be in the same insurance network as the ASC. That's the way that we're involved in that issue. And, what I would love to see is, rather than have to wait for a law or a regulation to mandate something on surgery centers, I think it would be a good thing for ASCs on behalf of their patients to do a better job of educating the patient about the potential for an out-of-network bill, even though they're coming to an in-network surgery center.
So, one of the things to look at probably is what New York did, which is a relatively simple system, even though everybody complains about it. It's just, notification. You provide the patient prior to surgery list of, the providers and who they're contracted with so that you have that information. You know, if you haven't provided that information prior to that date of surgery, so at least that information is there.
Whether actually the ASC is aware of it, but at least make the patient aware of the fact that there's a potential and recommend to the patient that they contact their insurance carrier
to determine
to make that determination. I think that simple step will be very helpful. And I think, again, we want to do right by our patients. And that's a very simple way, I think, of helping them, because we all know how complicated healthcare is and healthcare financing is.
So tell me what's going on with the ASC Association.
Well, we're doing very well. We're obviously, have very pleased about what we've been able to accomplish for ASCs, with CMS on these past couple of payment rules. Every year, I think we're building greater support in Congress amongst both Democrats and Republicans for the things that we stand for. We'll be reintroducing our ASC bill in the next few days, which seeks to solidify some of the things that we've already accomplished, by regulation. And so it's good to get things locked into stone by having them be in law rather than subject to the whims of one administration to the next. We're obviously always looking to grow membership. There are still too many surgery centers out there that don't recognize the value of what we and their state ASC association are doing for them. When we are, so small in terms of numbers, in terms of, you know, relative to the hospitals and to the insurance companies, and it was our ability to try and get up to the hill and impact change and spend money to try and, you know, elect people that support the things that we support. That said, if we were all marching in the same direction, all, you know, working together, we can really get a lot done. And and so I would really hope that more surgery centers would understand that value and that the relatively small price of our membership really pays dividends in terms of things we're accomplishing, in terms of reducing regulatory burdens, you know, increasing payments with Medicare and Medicaid, working with commercial payers to try and make sure that they understand the value of ASCs and are doing more within their networks to try and drive care to us because it saves, you know, the system money. So I think we've been very successful in terms of trying to create a better public image of surgery centers, making sure that, you know, the health media, that policymakers, that members of the public have a better understanding of what a surgery center is and the good things that we're doing to control healthcare costs without limiting quality of care.
Right. And all the other benefits that come with, especially we've come off of two incredible education programs. I have a vested interest in this since I'm on the education committee, but we really ask a 2019 and the winter seminars in January were just incredible.
Well, and John, you've been such a valuable addition to that with you know, the speaking that you've done for us over the years. We're always looking to find the best people, the, the, you know, the most accomplished experts in their field to come and talk about things that matter to the surgery center team, whether it's the administrator, the nurses, and other staff. And we're actually looking to focus more on that. We want to try and find ways to kind of identify different education for different folks on the ASC team so they can get the education they need to succeed in their jobs and in their career.
Right. And I think we just opened up registration for ASC winter seminars, right?
Correct. In New Orleans.
New Orleans.
It's going to be a real fun place to be in February.
We're having fighting within the company as to who's going. So I'm going.
It's a long weekend. It's Martin Luther King weekend.
Oh, is it really?
You know, every year we held it at the same week. So that there's that little extra opportunity for many folks to stay over an extra day. We're putting together some great education for it. And as I said, we're trying to make sure that that education is impactful, that it's going to help the folks who attend do better in their careers, provide better care in the surgery center, and help patients more.
Right. And then don't forget about ASCA 2020 coming up in Orlando in
It'll be in May.
In May.
So we're looking forward to that. We're already putting together, you know, and finalized a great education agenda there. 3 days of really good education on a wide range of topics, whether they're financial or operational or clinical, that can, you know, help surgery centers succeed.
Absolutely. So where do they go to join?
They go to ASCassociation.org, and I've got a crack membership team
who
loves to talk to potential members and explain the myriad benefits that we offer to surgery centers. And because, again, that membership has to matter within the center. I mean, the things that we do have to help the physicians, the nurses, the team in the surgery center. And then also we have a mission to try and make sure that the whole ASC healthcare delivery model succeeds and thrives. And I think that we have married together those twin goals in a way that really makes membership really important and valuable.
Right. And I hear we're seeing each other in Ohio
in a couple of weeks.
And then I heard that you're coming to New York also again. So
I will be coming to New York again. Some great work going on in New York in terms of the establishment of a kind of a rebooted state association.
Thanks a lot, by the way, to the ASC Association. You really did help us out. I mean, that's not generally known out there, but we really, many of these state associations are struggling because they just don't have the resources. And ASC Association has been great. Allie, you know, with your organization has been great helping us out. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Because, you know, I always say that, you know, belonging to and supporting just either your national association or your state association is like insuring one half of your car.
Right.
You really need to be protected all the way around. And the only way you can do that is to belong to both your, you know, ASCA at the national level and your state association. And, you know, we've been working very hard over the years, and particularly in the last few years, with actually the support of some of the large management companies, to try and infuse some additional dollars into that state affairs effort. To, one, help put out a particular fire if there's a significant legislative or regulatory challenge in a specific state, to have some resources to bring to bear to there that the state association may not be able to afford, as well as also to go into some states, like, for example, New York, and help them create a more robust state presence. Now, there are some states out there that are too small, have too few surgery centers to actually have a full-fledged association, but they still should have some kind of alliance, some kind of way to unite, particularly when it comes to a legislative or regulatory challenge, because something bad that happens in a small state, say Wyoming or South Dakota, can have ramifications in larger states, because state lawmakers talk to each other, they look to see what other states are doing. So if a domino falls in one state, it can quickly go to another, which is why we have to always be kind of mindful of what's happening around us.
Thanks so much, Bill. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm sorry it took this long for me to get in front of the microphone, but hopefully it won't be my last.
That's absolutely true.
So again, we want to thank Bill for graciously being a guest on our podcast here and spending some time with us to talk about national issues.
Well, that's it for the special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Please join us again, and please make sure you listen to our regular episodes. We've got 65 of them out there now. And please spread the word about our podcast to your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.